This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Thank you all for coming tonight. Welcome to this remarkable event co-sponsored by Warix and the Revell Forum. As I was introduced, I'm Seth Lehrer. I'm Dean of Arts and Humanities here at UCSD. And it's a remarkable opportunity to have this conversation with Salman Rushdie tonight about his new book, Joseph Anton, a memoir. If anyone does not need an introduction, it is Salman Rushdie. But since I was asked to be here, I'm not going to shirk the responsibility. Salman Rushdie is the author of 11 novels. Some of you may know his work through Midnight's Children, which was awarded the Booker Prize in 1981, and then subsequently the Booker of all Bookers. Novels, in addition to that, Grimish, Shame, The Satanic Verses, the remarkable children's book, Haroon and the Sea of Stories, The Moor's Last Sigh, The Ground Beneath Her Feet, Fury, Shalimar the Clown, which I understand 7 years ago was the occasion for Salman's previous visit here to La Jolla and UCSD, The Enchantress of Florence, Luca and the Fire of Life, a remarkable collection of essays, nonfiction writing, and also screenplays. And it's my understanding that Midnight's Children will be opening this fall in the Toronto Film Festival, as well as Sundance, Telluride.
Not Sundance.
Not Sundance.
It's been at Telluride and Toronto, and it's going to be in London Film Festival.
And I hope to a theater near us sometime.
Very soon, I hope, yeah.
Excellent. And so, as many of you know, Salman Rushdie's new memoir, Joseph Anton, tells, among other things, the story of his life under the fatwa in the aftermath of the publication of The Satanic Verses. The book has just appeared in the United States, and it's my understanding that not only has it appeared in the United States and the UK, but in 16 other languages simultaneously.
Yeah.
And so my hope tonight is that we're able to have a conversation here on stage for about 40 minutes or so, and then we'll be turning it over for about 15 minutes or so of audience questions. And then after that, Mr. Rushdie has generously agreed to do a book signing up at the desk over there on that side of the stage. So I'm wondering if I could lead off. And many of us, I think, in coming to this book, will expect a primarily political and cultural book. But when I had the opportunity to read it this week, I saw it as a book about families. And I was struck by a couple of quotations in the book. And one quotation is when you're writing about The Wizard of Oz, and you say that the two great themes of the film, The Wizard of Oz, were home and friendship. And I'm wondering if you could talk about home and friendship in Joseph Anton, and something about the ways in which, for many of us in the audience who haven't had a chance to read the book, they might find something meaningful about home and friendship in it.
Well, that's... Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. When I wrote that piece about The Wizard of Oz, it was in the middle of this bad time. I mean, it was not long after it began. And the idea of home had suddenly become very problematic, you know, because I actually had a home, but I wasn't allowed to go and live in it. And so it kind of became a very fractured idea, you know. I was having to find places to be, and et cetera. And it's very unsettling. But also, of course, I mean, the way my life has gone, the idea of home has been very complicated anyway. You know, I've always thought that really, if I'm anything, I'm a big city person. You know, I feel at home in the big city. And most of my life has been lived in three very big cities, which is Bombay, London, and New York. And I think actually, if you know how to live in a city, you can live in any city. And cities are alike, because they have a similarity of ethic. You know? And so I've always thought that's really probably the closest I get to the idea of home, is that, you know, don't put me in the countryside. You know, the countryside is for cows. Actually, what I really like is to have friends with homes in the countryside, because then you could go and leave.
So would you say as a writer that you experience life in the city but write in the country?
No. I like writing in the city. I mean, I like all the kind of noise and smell and all that. I mean, who would live in New York if they didn't like noise and smell and so on? You know? It becomes like the symphony of the street, you know, is you have to enjoy that. So yeah, I think that's the question of home became, of course, very, very central to the way in which my life was led in that decade from 1989 onwards. And I mean, the other thing you say is friendship, and that's true. I mean, it's you know, one of the things about Dorothy in the movie is that any sort of parental figure that she has is really pretty useless. You know, I mean, you know, Aunt Em, Uncle Henry, they can't even protect her dog, you know, let alone her. And, I mean, the Wizard of Oz is useless. You know, she goes looking for the Wizard of Oz, he's a fraud. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain, you know. And what she has instead are friendships that she makes along the Yellow Brick Road, you know. And one of the big themes in this book, I think, is the way in which I was helped by friendships, you know, and one of the things that's been most pleasurable to do in writing it has been to tell that story, because we've all kept our mouth shut for 23 years, you know, and nobody knows who did what, and people did a lot, and it's nice to finally not keep my mouth shut and say, look what these people did. I mean, look how extraordinarily they behaved. You know, one of the things that people, by which I mean journalists mostly, would say, did I find in that period that people kind of edged away from me? You know, that they didn't want to be endangered by association, and so on. And actually, it's the opposite of what happened. What happened was that people came closer, wanting to help. And my close friends came closer, and people who had not been close friends became close friends. I mean, one of the most celebrated of which was Christopher Hitchens, who we mourn, you know, and it's a big hole in the world. But he was somebody who I was friendly with, but he wasn't a close friend in 1989. You know, he was living in D.C., I was in London, I didn't see that much of him, etc. And when all this started, he took the very conscious decision to come, you know, to take a big step next, to come and stand next to me, and became this colossal ally. And, you know, if you're in a fight, you want Christopher on your side. You know, you don't want him on the other side, that's for sure. You know? So he became a great friend in need, you know, and that was true of a lot of people. And so that's is a big theme in the book.
And do you think that for those of us who will be reading the book, that we can learn about how friendship is tested in adversity?
Yeah, well, you know, anybody who writes, well, fiction knows that one of the principles of fiction is that crisis reveals character. You know, that if you put people into a condition of crisis, you know, you shipwreck them, you do something, you know, it you find out what they're like. You know? And this was a kind of shipwreck. You know? We often used to say to each other that what this attack, the fatwa, you know, what it was like this very bright light shining down on people's behavior. So there was like, there were no hiding place, you know, no shades of gray. Sorry. It's, It's strange how perfectly ordinary phrases suddenly become unusable.
Well, I think that's wonderful. And you know, when we prepared for this, they told me to give you all the good lines.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I remember, you know, talking of these unusable phrases, I remember that the Latin American writer Carlos Fuentes used to say about García Márquez that he said it's very difficult now in Latin American literature to use the word solitude, because everybody thinks that you're making a reference to García Márquez. And he said, what really frightens me, that it might soon be impossible to use the phrase 100 years, because you'd be making a reference to... So I guess Shades of Grey is getting into that slightly less distinguished work, I have to say.
Since home and friendship are so central to the book, I'm wondering if we could also talk about families. And one of the most genuinely poignant and moving sections of the book, at least for me, is the early section, where you talk about your own family in India. And I was struck in reading it through. There's a wonderful quotation that you offer from the anthropologist Edmund Leach, who says, and I'm quoting from you, quoting him, "The family is the source of all our discontent."
Yeah, it was worse than that. He did... He gave these very prestigious lectures every year on the BBC called the Reith Lectures. And he was asked to do that, and he did it on the theme of the family. And he began, he said, I'll get this right. He said, the family with its narrow privacy and tawdry secrets is the source of all our discontents, he said. So, you know, that's just, and lots of people were cross. But you know what that, I mean, there's a big truth in that, which is we all pretend that family life is kind of fab. You know, it's great. How are things at home? Great. You know, and actually, you know, when you shut the door, it's sort of hell in there. You know, but you don't want anyone else to know that.
Right.
So, anyway, so, I mean, one of the things I'm happy to have done in the book is that to write about my father in an affectionate way. You know, because I think anyone who knows my work knows that there's one or two books which have portraits of difficult relationships between fathers and sons. I mean, well, the Satanic Verses has one, and Midnight's Children has one too, I think. And that's, you know, no, it's no secret that I had a difficult relationship for a long time with my father. But, well, A, we made it better before the end, and that was important. And B, there was always, even in the difficult times, we both knew that we were very like each other. You know, we were so like each other that people used to mistake our voices on the phone. You know, I would answer the phone and his friends would start talking to me as if I was him, and I would have to say to stop before they say anything embarrassing, you know, stop. I'll go get him. And I found writing the book, this book, that it became clearer to me, even than it already was, how alike we were, you know, and how much of his way of seeing became my way of seeing, and you know, how much of his areas of interest, how many of his areas of interest became mine, and there was this great continuity, sort of intellectual continuity between us, and it was nice to be able to tell that story.
What do you think he truly taught you?
Well, he excused me religion. That was important. See, you say this in America, there's always silence. It's such a religious country, you know. But actually, I was fortunate to be let off religion, because my father had none, really. But I mean, he really had none. And so I inherited that. But he had a great interest in it, scholarly interest in it. And he was much more of a scholar of Islam than me, for instance, because he spoke classical Arabic and Farsi and was able to read these texts in the original and so on. But really, he interested me in the subject of the historical origins of Islam, and to treat this idea like any other idea, as something that grew out of a particular place and time, a particular set of social and economic and political circumstances, a particular set of actual family circumstances. The actual character and life of the Prophet, you know, became... And that's how you would normally study the growth of any idea. If you wanted to study Marxism, you would study the life of Marx and the times of Marx and et cetera. So, same thing. And he gave me that area of interest, and I pursued it.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that so much in the book is really about not just being a son, but being a father? And what is the interplay between your relationship as a son and your growth as a father in the book.
Well, you know, the famous Larkin poem is not wrong. You know, they fuck you up, your mom and dad. You know, they may not mean to, but they do. They give you all the faults they had and then some extra just for you. that's true. But what I thought was, I knew the things that had gone wrong between my father and me, and I sort of knew what he'd done wrong, if you like, and I thought, let me not make those mistakes. And if you're going to make mistakes, make different mistakes. And so I just have put a lot of effort into being my son's father. And of course, one of my sons was only nine. Zafar, my older son, was only nine when this terrible thing began, and he was, you know, 21 when it finished. So he had to grow up through this. And during that time of growing up in this very embattled condition, he also had to suffer the loss of his mother, who died of cancer when he was 20. And so, you know, he had to go through a lot. And I think it brought us very close because of that.
Do you think in some sense he is as much, if not more, the hero of the book as Joseph Anton is?
I think he's one of them, you know, and I think there's a lot of heroic figures in the book, none of whom have my name. There's a lot of, you know, booksellers, publishers, friends, and yes, him too.
Yes. I'm wondering if, speaking of heroism, I'm reminded of the opening of Dickens' David Copperfield, where he starts off by saying, if I am to be the hero of my own life, let these pages show.
And, yeah, well, I'm definitely not the hero of my own life, but I was surrounded by a lot of people who were.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to tell that story. I'm talking of David Copperfield, by the way. I always wanted to write a book that had a person's name in the title as the title. You know,
because
it feels solid. You know, David Copperfield, Huckleberry Finn. You know, Tom Jones, Robinson Crusoe. You know, Daniel Deronda. That you think those are books. You know, I thought I want one of those.
Tell us about Joseph Anton. I think most of us will know, even just from the reviews and the discussion, that you've chosen the title as the pseudonym you took.
Yeah, and partly because I really hated it. I hated having to have a pseudonym. And I was very happy when I was able to give it up. But I thought it might just dramatize for people how strange those days were to be asked to give up your name. You know, and not just your name, but, you know, the ethnicity of your name. Don't choose an Indian name, too obvious, you know? So I just thought that would be the reason for putting it in the title.
So Joseph is Joseph Conrad.
Joseph came from Conrad, and Anton came from Chekhov. And partly it's to do with the fact that it just sounded like it might exist, you know?
Google Joseph Anton, you get many people other than the book.
I know. Well, you know, there's no copyright in names, you know? David Copperfield does magic tricks.
And Tom Jones, what
and
we
Tom
know about
Jones,
him.
Tom yes. Jones, you know, sings. I think Robinson Crusoe is still safe. it's partly because it sounded all right, but also because I felt in some way that both those writers had something to do with the world I found myself in, you know, that I felt that Chekhov, you know, is a great poet of melancholy and, you know, alienation, and longing to be somewhere else other than the place you are, you know. And I felt a bit like one of his three sisters, you know, dreaming of Moscow and not being able to go. I found myself feeling Chekhovian. It's a sad feeling, of course, but that, and then Conrad, I mean, apart from the fact that I admire these writers, but Conrad, there's a particular line in Conrad, which I remember talking to my great friend, the late Edward Said, a great Palestinian intellectual.
And a great Conrad scholar.
And a great Conrad scholar. And, you know, when he was fighting this long, whatever it was, 7-year battle against his cancer, he talked often about this particular line, from Conrad's novel, The Nigger of the Narcissus, about this sailor who's dying of tuberculosis on aboard a ship. And eventually one of the other sailors says to him, "Why do you get on the ship? And if you knew you were sick, why do you get on the ship? Why didn't you stay home?" And he says this famous line. He says, "I must live till I die, mustn't I?" And it's a really profound line. And I mean, Edward, you know, used to say that that was an inspiration to him. And he certainly did. You know, he went on traveling and lecturing and teaching and writing. And, you know, and he lived right up until he died. And I thought that's... You know, that became like a motto for me as well.
Well, one of the questions that I think many people will have is what the relationship is between book and life, and not simply in the case of autobiography or in the case of factuality, but in the sense that, as you say, when a book leaves its author's desk, it changes. This whole question of what happens to the book or what happens to our lives once it's published and gets out in the world. And one of the things that I experience when I teach is very often... many students want me to tell them what the author intended.
Yeah.
And I say the issue is not what the author intended. The issue is what the history of response or the cultural environment might be or what our responses are. And I'm wondering, since you've written a book that's been very much about what you intended, if you could talk a little bit about your sense of that relationship between intention
and afterlife. Well, you know, I mean, in a kind of pure world, a writer wouldn't have to explain his book. You know, and in a way, it's much better not to. It's much better to put the book out there and let people take from it what they want to take from it. You know, that's it. And partly that is nowadays screwed up by the machinery of the book tour. You know, where at the moment where you want to be most absent, you have to be most present. You know, at the moment where you just want people to read the book and think about it, you have to come and tell them all about it, you know? And so partly this is just the nature of how the publishing industry is now, and you know, we all have to do it. And there's some pleasure in it. There's pleasure of coming out to meet your readers and so on. But I think ideally, the book tour should happen like 3 months after the book comes out, you know, so that people have a chance to read it and think about it. Then let's talk about it. You know, but this is not how the economics of the publishing business works. So you can't do that. But I've always had that worry about, because I think, you know, the author saying, "Here's what I meant," is a very authoritative, statement, and it can crush other versions of the book. You know, the people could be reading the book and finding in it this or that. But if the writer said, "This is what I actually mean," that kind of jumps on top of these other readings and can crush them. And in fact, you actually, as a writer, you want all those other readings, you know, because I've always believed that the reader completes the book. You know, that the great thing about the novel is that it happens inside the reader's mind, you know, and it becomes this intimacy of strangers, you know, the intimate engagement between the reader's imagination and the writer's imagination. You know, that they come together like that, and that makes the book for that reader. And different readers will find different things, and that's part of the joy of writing and reading. But with the Satanic Verses, what happened is that, first of all, it wasn't just to do with the violence of the attack, is that there was a description of the book that sort of began to circulate far more widely than my ability to overcome it, which in my view was a false description. I mean, not just a variant reading, but an actual lie about what was in the book. And so I found during those years, and I mean from then to now really, that I actually had to do this business of trying to salvage my book from under this pile of shit that had been thrown on top of it, you know? And to say, you know, it's not like that, it's like this. And I mean, I felt often the awkwardness that I've been describing, and that I'm over-explaining, you know, and I don't want to over-determine people's reading to it, you know. But on the other hand, I also wanted to save it from uh, from this distortion.
Isn't that part of the delicacy of reading and writing, where we draw the line between a variant interpretation and a false description?
Well, there are things. Somebody says there's something in the book which actually isn't in the book. You know, I mean, that's a false description. And there was a lot of that. So, I mean, I think we could get into, there are some sort of serious reasons for the argument. But a lot of the argument was not serious. It was people who'd never read the book just being pointed, you know, in this kind of what we see now, this the skill with which outrage is manufactured. You know, and this was one of the early examples of that, of the functionings of the outrage industry.
Exactly. Well, I'm wondering if I can just think about this in terms of the experience of reading your work, because so much of what you do is extremely playful. It's a play of voices in many ways. And I was, in reading Joseph Anton, I came across this wonderful moment when you encounter an oral storyteller in South India. And you say the oral story had survived because of its adoption of complexity and playfulness, its rejection of start-to-finish linearity. So many of your books are so playful, so non-linear, so multi-voiced. No,
well, I just thought that this is this ancient form, and I always was impressed by it. You know, you go, particularly South India, Kerala, there's a lot of very, very super popular oral storytellers. And when you go and sit in these big crowds, they tell stories in a very strange way because they constantly digress. You know, instead of, I think it's the, is it not the advice of the, it's the, of the King of Hearts to the White Rabbit in Alice, because the rabbit is having trouble giving evidence. And the King of Hearts says, start at the beginning, go on until you reach the end, and then stop. And this is supposed to be, this is classical form, right? This is how you're supposed to write. But that's not what happens. An oral storyteller will usually start with an anecdote, which can be fictional or it can be personal. And he will immediately digress by comparing it to a mythological story, which kind of inflates it to a much grander level. Then he will interpolate a political anecdote of something that he's pissed off about at the time. And then he'll sing a little song. There's usually some musical instruments. So there's like four or five different narrative balls being thrown into the air, you know.
And you learned from that.
Yeah, because you think the thing you do is you watch. You're watching for him to drop the ball. It's just like exactly like juggling. You know, the excitement is he going to drop the ball? And the pleasure is no, he doesn't. And just when you think he's going to, he tosses two more balls at the air. You know, and then he juggles more balls. You know? And that's the thrill of the oral narrative.
And that's the thrill of reading so many of your novels. That's the thrill we get.
Well, I hope so. And you have, what I thought, I did think early on, I thought there must be a written down version of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you obviously can't do it exactly the same way, but there must be a written down version of that. And I tried to find one.
Let me ask then, in terms of the craft of writing, since I think probably many of the students here, many of us here are writers, we're certainly all readers. I was struck by, in the book, you're writing about a time when the act of reading and writing went on the page. When it went on before the computer screen primarily. And you mentioned The Moor's Last Sigh was the first novel that you wrote on a computer. And I'm wondering if the kinds of things we're talking about, the experience of writing, the playfulness, the interactivity, how do you feel that's changed in the 2.5 decades since the book tells this? You think it's the same?
It's the same. I think certainly, the computer is a tool. You find out how to use it. And I used to find, you know, you'd buy a new pen. For the first couple of days, the pen was trying to make you write its sentences. You know? And gradually, you defeat it.
Yes.
You know? And then it's writing your sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a computer is the same thing. That for like 5 minutes, you think, oh, this is very strange. And then it just becomes the thing you use. I like gadgets, so I was happy to have made the shift from typewriter to computer.
What about the internet as a gadget? You mentioned in the book that things would have been very different had there been Google and the internet and YouTube.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is difficult. You have to remove from the image so many things that we now take for granted. You know, no web. You know? I mean, like, you know, the most sophisticated thing we had was a fax machine, and landline telephones plugged into the wall. That. So yes, everything's much faster now, and I think in many ways it would have been more dangerous. I mean, the attack on the Satanic Verses would have been more dangerous because it would have been able to, the message of, you know, which was being put out by the people attacking the book would have been disseminated at much greater speed and would have been replicated at much greater speed. And I think it would have been worse. Yeah, I think it was in a way my good fortune to have this happen just before the information age, you know. And by the time that age was in its full flood, you know, this tide was receding a little bit. I mean, I remember somewhere around, what was it? Is it 1998, the year of Google? I think it is. I remember somebody saying to me, because, you know, we had all these search engines that didn't work, and they were endlessly freezing and jamming and so on, and they didn't find you anything useful. And then I remember somebody saying to me, there's this thing called Google. I thought, this is a stupid name. And they said, no, just try it, because it's really useful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was at that moment for all of us that the internet suddenly opened, just suddenly unfolded, you know, and became the incredibly useful thing it is, but also, as we see...
But the incredibly dangerous thing.
Dangerous thing,
absolutely.
You know, particularly because so many stupid idiots on the internet. Sorry, stupid idiot.
If we can think of, and if we can think of our intelligent and well-read group.
Yeah, no, sorry, it's not me, not you. Those other stupid idiots in the other room.
That's right. The rest of the book tour. I'm wondering if we can. Well, I guess, maybe I should ride with that. Are we less intelligent than we used to be? Were there always stupid idiots? Are there more stupid idiots? Does the internet make us more stupid or idiotic?
I don't know. I mean, I think maybe it just makes it easier for us to put out the stupidity that is within us. It allows us to express our inner deep stupidity, which previously we had to keep to ourselves because there wasn't a way of sharing it with the planet.
I understand that. I guess I'm reminded of this passage that I found in the essay Is Nothing Sacred, and that is that whenever in the world the little room of literature has been closed, sooner or later the walls have come tumbling down. And I'm wondering what this place of literature is now. I mean, we're speaking kind of jokingly, but it is true. We live in a dangerous time. We live in a time when opinion is perhaps more unregulated than it has been. Does literature play a role today in helping or hindering our discourse?
You know, you say that we live in that time, but we also live in the opposite time, which is a time in which people are trying to control what it's acceptable to say more than 50 years ago, for example. There's an attempt to limit by threats and menaces and so on what is sayable in the world, you know. And I think that's something that writers have always gone up against, like as a reflex action.
Do you feel that the writer now has a different or uniquely special role?
No, it's always been this. I mean, you know, one of the things that happens is when you live in a genuinely free society or something close to it, you know, like this one, for example, it's less important to take up those cudgels because you have the freedoms. You know, you don't have to fight for them that hard. You have to sometimes fight to defend them against people who are trying to chip them away. But, you know, on the whole, you have what you want, you know. But if you look at parts of the world, and it's not just now, it's always been true, any part of the world in which people start trying to shut that down, the first line of attack is writers. I mean, one of the things that tyrants most fear appears to be writers. And it's very strange because writers have no armies. You know, there's not much they can do except tell the truth. There's a wonderful line in Italo Calvino's novel, If on a Winter's Night a Traveler, where he says, I won't get it quite right, but he said, you can always tell the degree of importance that a society accords to literature by the size of the apparatus it sets up to repress it. You know?
So Tsarist Russia, for example,
respected literature a lot. Mm-hmm. United States, not so much. And it's sort of true.
Well, it reminds me of this passage in the book where you say that you learned from the Urdu writer Ahmed Faiz that the writer's task was to be both public and private, an arbiter of society and the human heart. And what interests me about that is not just the content, but that you learned it from Urdu.
Faiz, Ahmed Faiz, great poet. I mean, one of the great poets of the 20th century in the Indian subcontinent. He was the first great writer I ever met. You know, and he was a family friend, and he was sort of my aunt's best friend, kind of. And he was like an extra uncle, and I knew him all my life. I knew him from when I was this big to when I was grown up, and he was this interesting. I mean, first of all, there were ways in which we were not alike. I mean, he was a card-carrying member of the Communist Party. He was a winner of the Lenin Prize, etc., and never stopped being a communist. But he had this ability to write in many different manners. You know, so he wrote love poetry, famous love poetry in the Ghazal form, and many of these were set to music and became popular songs. They're always rather disenchanted love poems. I think it would be slightly ambiguous to have Faiz write a love poem about you, because there's always a kind of needle in it, you know. Do not ask of me, my love, that love I once had for you. You know, thanks a lot, Faiz. but as well as that, this wonderfully sensual, intimate literature, he also wrote public poetry and essays, and some of the most important poems written about the partition of India and Pakistan, for example, are written by him. And he was somebody who felt that you needed to be able to have both voices, speak in both voices, you know. And I thought, I mean, I just grew up thinking, oh, well, that's what you do. If you're a writer, that's what you do.
You have a public voice as well.
Yeah, you have a public voice and a private voice. And so I just assumed that's what you did.
Well, let me loop back to two questions that may wrap up our part of the discussion. And thinking about the experience in India and getting back to the issue of the city, of Bombay, there's a wonderful line in the book where you quote the Somali writer Nuruddin Farah. Where is Somali? He says, I keep it here. So where do you keep
India? Same place. I mean, the heart is where these things live. And for a long time, I mean, it was one of the books of mine that I'm most proud of is The Moor's Last Sigh, because it was probably just, in a certain way, the hardest book to write for me, because it's a book entirely about modern India, written at a time when I wasn't able to go there. And it's the only one of my books that I think of as a novel of exile, you know, because otherwise I might not have been living in India, but I was going all the time and I never felt that I'd really lost touch. But there was this period of, you know, whatever it was, 8 years or something when I couldn't go. And it was a great deprivation. And then I worried a lot that when this book came out, people would think, oh, you know, he's out of touch.
Yes.
You know, he's writing.
But it wasn't received that way.
I mean, that was actually, I say in the book somewhere, that's kind of the best review I ever got, you know, was that when the book came out, there were a couple of friends of mine in Bombay who called me up and said, you bastard, you came and you didn't tell us. and I said, you know, no. And they said, no, you must have done. How do you know all this stuff? You couldn't possibly know all this stuff. And I thought, okay, good, thank you very much. I'll take that. You know, it was a big relief, really.
In a sense, like Joyce writing about Dublin years
ago. Yeah,
after
you know, Joyce sitting with in his pocket the copy of the Irish Times, you know, from, what is it, June the 16th?
19th.
Yeah, you know, Bloomsday. And almost the day he met his wife, the day he met Nora Barnacle. kept the newspaper of the day he met her. And almost everything in that newspaper is in the book, you know, including the advertising. You know, what is life without plum trees, potted meat? Incomplete. You know, with it, an abode of bliss. You know, the horse throwaway yes. that wins the 230.
That's right.
You know, it's, there it is. I mean, every single article in the newspaper finds its way.
Does
in
that
the novel.
Stay with you because you began your career as an advertising copywriter?
Maybe. I mean, it stays with me because it's funny. You know,
but many of your ads were funny too.
Is
it true that you coined yes. naughty but nice?
Yes. No, I didn't coin it. I used it. I mean, the phrase is older than that. You know, that you can trace that phrase back to, like, the 1940s. Almost, you know, but I used it for cream cakes, to advertise cream cakes, and actually I didn't do a very good job of pitching it, because when we talked to the cream cakes client, and I showed him the stuff, and he said, "You're telling people that cream cakes make them fat," and I said, "You know what, sir? They know that." I said, "You should concentrate on the but nice."
Right. Well, so much of literature is about telling us, in some sense, what we already know as well.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if we can wrap up our conversation part of the evening with, I want to ask if you might speak to some of the students in the audience. And I came across this passage, which I thought was a challenge as well as a statement for anyone who wants to be a creative writer. You said that to write a book is to make a Faustian contract in reverse. To gain immortality, or at least posterity, you lose, or at least ruin, your actual daily life.
it's not fun being a writer. You sit on your bottom all day. You know, there's a famous line of Hemingway's about that, you know, and Hemingway was asked about commitment, whether writers should have commitment, and he said the only commitment a writer needs is the commitment to the seat of his pants, to the seat of his chair. And it's a very important fact about writing, you have to keep sitting down. If you get up, you're not writing. You know, sit the fuck down.
I can see that's going to be the takeaway line of the evening.
And, you know, so you are sacrificing. There's a beautiful summer's day outside. Everybody else is doing beautiful summer's day things. And you're just sitting there.
And the rewards for sitting there?
For most of us are not that great.
And yet so many of our students, so many of us aspire to be writers.
Well, good luck to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sir Salman Rushdie. Now, at this time, it's my understanding that we have about 15 minutes or so for questions from the audience, and we have two microphones, one on either side of the auditorium. So we have a couple of people lined up here, and if you're game.
Yes, go for
sir?
It.
Sir?
Hey there. I know you primarily from Christopher Hitchens, and I was curious if you might tell us a story about him, maybe a disagreement you had that was particularly memorable.
A disagreement?
A disagreement.
A debate.
A debate, a disagreement you had that was particularly memorable, other than the one we had in the green room.
Well, you know, the biggest disagreement that Christopher and I had was about Iraq. And he's very difficult to argue with because he's very good at it. And I can't use the past tense.
Because he still lives presently.
Yeah, you know. And he also could be very rude. Christopher is a street fighter. You know, he didn't fight nice. You know, if he could kick you in the balls, he would. he made him a formidable opponent. And, you know, we did disagree about Iraq, but I think the fact is many of his friends disagreed with him about that, for example. And there's a point at which you just had to ask yourself, okay, you know, I think he's wrong, but what, is he going to stop being my friend? You know, and you think, no, I just think he's wrong. and we'll go on having the argument, which we did. We more often than not agreed. Certainly about, as I say, he was a great ally in the matter of this, of the attack on the standing verses. And then I always felt that Christopher, you know, it's a strange thing to say about an atheist, but Christopher was saved by God. That, you know, Christopher, by finding his way to the attack on God, having finished with the attack on Mother Teresa and Henry Kissinger and so on, by the time he went up against the big guy.
You mean in God is not great?
Yes. I mean, it's sort of he found his voice, he found himself again. And I think God was his way back from Iraq, you know. And I mean, about that, I sort of agreed with him completely. Yeah.
I think we have some people lined up on the other side, so if we can take a question here from...
One of the things you've always mentioned is how betrayed you felt by the Indian government when it banned satanic verses. Today, what's happening in India seems to be actually worse when they're trying to ban so many other things. How do you think that happens when a society is actually supposedly getting freer, when the press is supposed to be getting freer, that we can actually curb freedom even more?
Well, I mean, it's a good question, and it's a very worrying development, you know, because in India, genuinely set out to be a free democratic society, you know, and there are, you can find any number of speeches made by the founding fathers of the country, Jawaharlal Nehru and so on, speaking passionately in favor of free speech. And even in their behavior, you know, there was in the early, the first 15 or 20 years after independence, there was savage satirical writing in the Indian press and you know, very cruel cartoons about all the main leaders of the country. And there was never any idea that you would, in any sense, attack the cartoonists or the satirists for that. It was just part of what there was in a free society. I mean, what would a respectful political cartoon look like? You know, I mean, the nature of the form is disrespect. And what's happened in the last 15, 20 years, I think, has been really worrying, because there's been a real attempt, well, the attempt mainly not by the state itself, but by various kinds of sectarian extremist groups to limit free expression, but the state never defends the people who are attacked and sort of gives a kind of tacit support. And this has been across the board. You find the attack on the painter M.F. Hussain forced him into exile, the attack on Rowinton Mystery's novel, Such a Long Journey, got it taken off the syllabus in Bombay University. The attack on A.K. Ramanujan's scholarly essay about the Ramayana got it taken off the syllabus of Delhi University. You know, art galleries have been attacked. Libraries containing ancient documents have been attacked. You know, it's across the board. It's literature, music, film, painting, and scholarship, all under attack. And nobody seems to care. And in fact, even the public doesn't seem to care. And when the public is asked, it has a sort of sit down, you're rocking the boat response, which is, why do artists want to make so much trouble? Can't you just tell us a nice story? You know, sing us a nice song. Why do you have to be so troublesome? It's your fault. See? And that shifting of blame has assisted the extremists with the tacit support of the state in shutting down areas of the conversation, you know, and it's one of the more worrying things about where India is right now, you know. I mean, don't ask me the solution. The solution is to keep yelling about it, you know, and hope we can change opinion.
Thank you. A question from this side, if we could.
Just a comment. Well, I'd like to thank you for reinforcing lessons that I've learned studying literature and Latin here at UCSD, especially that writers do shape the discourse of our culture. And so I don't feel that my degree was a waste of time, contrary to what my parents would say. And the other thing is that as a university graduate and as an atheist, I just want to thank you for keeping your integrity.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Do you want to take that, or do you want to just keep going? Okay. I think we have time, since So Salman will be doing a book signing. Let's take two more questions from the floor, one more from that side and one more from that side.
My question has to do with the comments in the form of a video that supposedly have to do with the book that disrespect the Muslim faith. It's so much in the news right now, this particular excerpt. One of the more intelligent things I've heard said about that is that we have a hard time understanding how the blame can be put on the United States for what some individual very poorly put together with regard to the Muslim faith. And the comment that I thought made a lot of sense was, if you grow up in a society in which government controls everything, it's very hard to believe that government isn't behind what went on here. And I just wonder what your comments might be.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some truth in that. It's true that if there are many countries of the world where if you want to make a film, you need government approval. And so it's easy to say that films or videos like this were made with the approval of the American government. But I don't know. Yes, I think there's truth in it, but I also think we know, I mean, everybody, we all know about YouTube by now. You know, YouTube didn't just happen the day before yesterday and anywhere in the world. And everybody knows that YouTube is just a place where you can throw any piece of crap. You know, and there it is. And I think there's people uploading videos onto YouTube from Muslim countries as well. You know, so I don't think it entirely works to say that because you live in a censorship environment, you know, you assume that anything produced in another country must also have the support of the government. I think it's much more deliberate than that. You know, and you had the head of Hezbollah saying that this was something organized by U.S. intelligence. And if you're having political leaders making that assertion to their followers, that's a much more powerful way in which the misunderstanding takes place. And that misunderstanding is deliberately created. It's not because, you know, Sheikh Nasrallah is not a stupid man. He knows perfectly well that this little video has nothing to do with the U.S. government. Or perhaps he just colossally overestimates the ability of the U.S. government, you know, to make things happen, which would be flattering. But I think it's in the end more to do with a deliberate desire by the political and politicized religious leaders of certain Muslim countries to twist the facts and to offer to their followers another reason for, you know, being outraged with America, because that outrage with America is something which serves their political interests. So I think you have to see this as a political event and not a religious event, and it seems to make more sense when you do.
Thank you. I think we have time for one more question from the audience from this side before the book signing.
Salman, I'm a quarter of the way through Joseph Anton. It's brilliant.
Thank you.
I've left off at the part where you're under police protection and you've acquired your first cell phone and you exchange
your phone
with Kazuo Ishiguro. He's just published Remains of the Day, and he says that essentially that the Satanic Verses is so good that the whole literary community should unite and basically celebrate the literary merits of the book. I can't remember. Were you championed by a lot of your colleague authors at the time?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I remember, for instance, that Ishiguro, when The Remains of the Day won the Booker Prize, you know, that he actually used his victory speech at the prize ceremony to defend me and my work. You know, so he definitely practiced what he preached. And yes, I mean, I would say that an enormous majority of the world's writers were fantastically supportive, including writers from Muslim countries. I mean, there was actually a book published in those years, originally in France, called Pour Rushdie, and then in English as For Rushdie, in which there were, I think, approximately 100 writers from different Muslim countries you know, speaking out in my defense. You know, so that was an important book at the time. And I put it like this: yes, of course, there were a few writers who weren't supportive, but they were so few that I can remember all their names. and you know, that's just my problem. But yes, I mean, really, on the—I mean, I remember, for instance, in New York, in the days after the attack began, that Susan Sontag was president of American Pen at the time, and she just went, you know, rolled up her sleeves and went to battle, and she essentially got every major writer in America, you know, to stand up in defense, including a few of them who weren't that keen to stand up, but Susan was, you know, Susan was tough. You didn't win an argument. I'd like to have seen Susan and Christopher Hitchens, you know. that would have been, you know, clash of the dinosaurs. But or the tyrannosaurs, perhaps. But, you know, she was a formidable person, and she certainly led American writers at that time in defense of the book. And I one of the reasons why, when things got better for me, and I was living in New York, I'd been living in New York, I became involved with American Pen, was that it was a writer's organization that I felt had really, you know, stood up for me. And now maybe my turn to do that for other people, you know, because there's writers are always in trouble. I wasn't the first one, I'm unfortunately not the last one. And we have to defend all the time writers in danger all over the world, you know, and so I think it's time to give back, you know, but it was partly inspired by how much was given to me.
We've concluded with the statement about American writers standing up for Salman Rushdie. I think for what I hope is not a once-in-a-lifetime experience, we can stand up for Sir Salman Rushdie.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.